Okay, let's unpack this. We've got some really fascinating source material today. We're digging into a huge story. Taylor Swift, her master recordings, and that whole journey with the re-recordings.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Today, we're diving into excerpts from a Billboard article dated June 3, 2025. It covers Taylor Swift actually buying her masters back and then looks at the legacy of the whole Taylor's Version project.
And specifically zooms in on All Too Well, 10-minute version.
Right.
Which became this massive thing.
Exactly. So our mission here is to pull out the key details, understand why artist ownership matters so much, the strategy behind re-recording, and yeah, how one song kind of became a cultural phenomenon out of all this.
Mm.
What does this whole story tell you about the music business and, I guess, the fight for artistic control?
Well, it's fascinating because owning your masters is like the holy grail. It really is.
Right.
And it's notoriously difficult, you know, even for someone like Taylor Swift. It's about controlling the actual recordings, the asset that makes money and decides how the music gets used. It's complex.
Okay, so let's start with the headline news from the article.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift announced she successfully purchased the masters for her first six albums.
Right, and the article mentions she got them from an investment firm, Shamrock Capital.
Mm-hmm.
The price wasn't disclosed, but you can imagine it must have been significant.
And the reaction described in the source, just jubilation from fans, obviously, but Swift herself, too. She called it her greatest dream come true.
Yeah, she even said something like she was trying to be pretty reserved about it, but you could tell it was monumental for her.
And that really underlines why it matters, doesn't it? She gets full control over that huge early part of her career's intellectual property.
Exactly. And the article stresses how rare this is. It calls the music industry Byzantine, which feels about right sometimes. Achieving this level of ownership, even for the biggest stars, is just not common.
Which brings us to the context, because this purchase didn't just happen overnight. It followed what, like a half-decade effort before she could buy them back?
Precisely. That whole Taylor's Version project, the motivation, according to the source, was a direct response to not having that creative ownership initially. That's what started it all.
And we saw four albums come out under that banner: Fearless, Red, Speak Now, and 1989. Those specific versions.
Right, in a Taylor's Version.
And they weren't just, you know, symbolic. The article is clear they were wildly successful.
Oh, absolutely. Fans really got behind it. 1989, Taylor's Version, apparently had an even bigger debut week than the original 2014 release did, which is kind of stunning when you think about it.
Okay, but this success, it wasn't just about her. The article points out it actually sent ripples through the wider industry.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting. Other artists started looking into re-recording as an option for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the flip side, you had labels reacting, reworking standard contracts to try and stop artists doing the same thing in the future.
So her move had genuine industry consequences.
Definitely. It wasn't just a personal victory. It started to shift the ground rules, or at least make people rethink them.
But even with all that success, the news she'd actually bought the originals caused some, the article says, consternation. It raised a bunch of new questions.
Right. Like, what happens now with the re-recording she hadn't finished?
Exactly. The source gives an update there. Her debut album, the self-titled one from 2006, was apparently fully re-recorded.
Okay.
But for reputation, Taylor's Version, Swift herself is quoted saying they haven't even re-recorded a quarter of it.
Huh. So that leads to the big questions the article throws out there.
Yeah. Will we ever see Reputation, Taylor's Version? Or the re-recorded debut album, now she owns the originals, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know?
And what about the four Taylor's Versions that are already out there and doing great? What's their status now?
The article doesn't really answer those future questions definitively, but it does spend time on the legacy those released Taylor's Versions have already created.
Which is significant. They definitely brought her older music to a whole new audience, right? Kids who maybe only knew her from Midnights or Folklore.
Exactly. And the source connects this directly to the Eras Tour. It says the re-recordings helped prime fans for that massive career-spanning tour.
And then helped cement her career year while the tour was going on. They kept that back catalog alive and relevant.
Plus, a huge part of the excitement was the From the Vault tracks.
Oh, yeah, the Vault tracks. Over 24 songs that had never been heard before, reworked for these versions.
The article mentions collaborations, like with Maren Morris, Fall Out Boy.
Right, and some Vault songs became actual hits. Message in a Bottle from Red, Is It Over Now, from 1989 even went to number one on the Hot 100.
But the article really elevates one Vault track above all others, calls it the greatest From the Vault song, and maybe the greatest musical legacy of the entire re-recording project.
Has to be All Too Well, 10-minute version.
Bingo.
I mean, the original was already a legend among fans, wasn't it? About 5.5 minutes on Red back in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Kind of tucked away between singles, but it just grew this massive following, a deep cut phenomenon.
And even then, people recognized it as this incredible piece of songwriting, right? A richly detailed examination, the source calls it.
Yeah, and it says it was an important moment for her storytelling, even hinting at where she'd go later with Folklore and Evermore.
So then, fast forward to 2021, Red, Taylor's version, drops. And there it is, the 10-minute version.
And the article addresses that, like, potential worry. Can you double the length of a beloved song without ruining it?
Right. But the verdict in the source is pretty clear. It says the 10-minute version towers above the original, calls it not overstuffed, an authoritative epic.
And a lot of that is down to how it expands the story, weaving in all those new details. The article lists them. The profane keychain, him not saying it's love, the inquisitive actress, chats with her dad, that awful 21st birthday.
Those specifics really add layers, don't they? And the source argues it works structurally because of how the verses stack and the chorus keeps subtly changing. It accommodates the longer format.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like padding. Yeah. Even the fade out, that sacred prayer, I was there, I was there. It makes the time passing feel really explicit.
And it lands emotionally. The source notes it doesn't feel forced, despite adding all these new Easter eggs for the fans.
The rollout was also key. The article mentions the short film All Too Well, the short film.
And that Saturday Night Live performance, performing the whole 10 minutes live on SNL, that was a moment.
Commercially, it just exploded. Top streaming charts instantly, hit number one on the Hot 100. First Taylor's version track to do that.
Yeah, the source points to that as proof of her still rising commercial power, even before Midnights came along and broke everything.
But beyond the charts, it's the cultural impact. The article argues it clued in countless casual listeners to a song fans already treasured.
And now it's seen as, what, a defining work, an encapsulation of her legacy as a modern songwriter. That's pretty heavy praise.
The source even floats the idea that, you know, years from now, critics or historians might point to this specific song to explain her impact.
Wow. And you see that playing out on the Eras Tour, right? The article mentions the full performance, the stadium sing-alongs.
Oh, yeah. Fans bellowing FK the patriarchy with uninhibited glee. The source calls it an anthem for all of us.
Which is kind of incredible for a 10-minute breakup song from a vault.
It really is. So we've traced this whole path. The fight for ownership, the strategy of re-recording, the eventual big purchase, and then this one song kind of unexpectedly becoming the defining artifact of the whole process.
Yeah, it's quite a journey. And for you, the listener, I think the takeaways here are pretty powerful. It's about, you know, artists needing to own their work. Mm. It's about the sheer creative and commercial energy that can be unlocked when they do get that control.
And how sometimes a single piece of art, like this song, can just grow and transform into something truly culturally significant.
Absolutely.
So thinking about all this, especially All Too Well, 10-minute version, emerging from this whole project designed to reclaim ownership, a project born from, let's face it, a difficult situation, what does its incredible success and legacy tell us? Maybe about the creative energy that can sometimes come from those challenging circumstances in the industry, not just in spite of them. What does that make you think about?